From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and our moderator, Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome to the show. Here are the issues. After threatening to not sign a much-needed COVID relief bill, President Trump gives it his blessing but leaves Congress scrambling. And more countries approve vaccines as COVID numbers continue to surge. Plus, the UK and the EU finally reach a post-Brexit deal. We'll tell you what you need to know. And we'll get the latest on a Christmas Day suicide bombing that shook the U.S. city of Nashville. Tom and Jonathan, excited to talk to you both. Lots to cover. Let's start with this massive bipartisan COVID relief package that this week President Trump signed into law. But there were a few very confusing days leading up to it. The relief bill, it was negotiated with the president's representative, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin. It was passed by Republicans in Congress who seemed to believe the president was on board with the bill. But then at the last minute, President Trump put the bill in jeopardy. He called it a disgrace. We were not certain he was going to even sign it, putting millions of people's unemployment benefits at risk. But then he did sign it. What changed his mind, Tom?
Well, I think what happened is he's down on vacation at his estate at Mar-a-Lago in Palm Beach, Florida. And he has a club there. He has a residence there. And when he's down there, it's easier for old friends and congressmen and senators, outsiders, and he also to get to him. And a lot of them were trying to persuade him one way or the other. I think he was vacillating. He wants to look like a populist here as he's heading out the door. He wanted to look like he was the big guy who was going to give the American people, long-suffering American people, more money. A lot of Republicans in the Senate, his Republicans, weren't all that thrilled about it. I think he played into the hands of the Democrats who said, oh, you want $2,000 more, Mr. President? We'll agree. We want that. Let's vote on it. So the democratically controlled House passed the $2,000 payment, and now it's tangled up in internal warfare deliberations in the Senate, which is controlled by the Republicans.
I want to go back to this issue that you brought up, that the president was pushing for larger direct payments. This bill calls for $600 for eligible Americans. The president is insisting that he wants $2,000 for eligible Americans. Jonathan, I'm still a bit confused here, because if the president was so keen on these larger payments, why didn't he push for it during the negotiation process, not after the bill was passed?
That's a very, very good question. The president essentially was entirely absent from the negotiations. He appointed as his negotiator the Treasury Secretary, Steven Mnuchin, and never really gave a number of how much money he wanted Americans to receive under the stimulus bill. Nancy Pelosi pressed Mnuchin several times during the negotiations to give him a number, and the $600 number was actually Mnuchin's number, not the president's, and he never really gave an indication of what the president wanted, because I don't think the president really said anything to Mnuchin. He was totally absent from these negotiations. And then, as you mentioned, he kind of swooped in after the bill had already been passed and said, oh, I want $2,000, which is what the Democrats have been asking for all along. So the basic answer is that he was absent from these talks until he decided to come in sort of as a deus ex machina at the very end to demand $2,000.
Basically, when he signed the package, the relief package, he said that essentially in return for signing it, Congress is going to look into election fraud. Again, there's been no evidence of mass election fraud that the president's been alleging. Also, regulations on tech companies and then these larger checks. But a bill like that, to couple all those issues together, none of that would actually get through the Democratic House. So did the president actually get anything from holding up this bill, Tom?
I don't think so. I don't think so at all. and as Jonathan has pointed out, he's been pretty much missing in action since the election. He hasn't engaged in this issue, and he hasn't engaged much in the COVID-19 issue, which we'll come to later. I don't think he got anything other than to call his Senate leadership, the Republican Senate leadership, incompetent, and call the efforts of his Treasury Secretary, one of his most loyal cabinet members, pathetic, and made Steven Mnuchin, the Treasury Secretary, look awfully bad by pulling out the rug from underneath him. I don't quite understand it, but I don't think the president got anything. I think you asked earlier, how did this happen? Well, I think a few members of Congress were able to persuade the president, look, Mr. President, we'll do all these other things you want on liability and other things, and we'll put that in another bill with $2,000, and we're going to make a good faith effort to deal with your objections there. And somehow I think the president was turned around, but that's not going to go anywhere either.
And Jonathan, it sounds like what Tom is saying, that the president threw his own party leadership under the bus. He threw his own Treasury Secretary under the bus with holding up this bill and also causing millions of people a lot of unneeded anxiety about whether or not they were going to be getting unemployment benefits from the government. Did he do this, do you think, to embarrass Republicans who aren't supporting his move to overturn the election? Or was this about getting Americans more cash? What do you see here?
Well, it's sort of a combination of both, I think. It's always difficult to sort of assess what Trump's motives are. But I think that he is very, very angry at Republicans for not supporting his claims of voter fraud and wanting to overturn the result of the election. I think what we're watching is that the president is basically conducting a scorched earth reaction to his own party. He's angry at them for not supporting him, and he doesn't really care whether he throws them under the bus or makes life difficult for them or embarrasses them or puts them in a very, very difficult position, which he has done right now.
I would say for sort of a president that follows the norms, this would look like President Trump self-sabotaging his own legacy, except that Donald Trump is the most dominant figure in the Republican Party. So this really puts Republicans in a tricky spot here, Tom, because on one hand, they need the president's support for their own elections. On the other hand, you see Republicans trying to stick up for the Republican ideas of fiscal responsibility and not giving out government money. How is this playing out?
Well, I just don't think it's playing well for Republicans these days. You're right. I think the Republicans in Congress would like to go back to what I might call the Republican Party of old, or days of yore, where they talked about fiscal responsibility. They didn't talk about it at all in the last couple of years when big spending legislation favored by the president was passed by them, and they had an enormous deficit. But now, with the Democratic president coming in, they want to talk more about fiscal responsibility. On the other hand, it should be noted that people are hurting and people need this money. And so I think the cries of certain Republican senators who say this is terribly irresponsible, that falls on deaf ears in a situation where you have tens of millions of Americans out of work, facing eviction notices early in the year. And so I don't think this is working well for Republicans, and I don't think it's working well for the president. I don't think he's getting the political bounce. On the other hand, it's very clear that the president has told some aides, you know, I can destroy a senator's reelection prospects with a single tweet. There's a little hyperbole there, but not a whole lot.
Right. We have seen President Trump, Republicans who have gone up against him, they lose their own elections. He does still have a lot of power. Even so, we are seeing Senate Republicans, at least the leadership, not very interested in even setting up a vote for the $2,000 checks. The other thing that's coming out of Congress this week is the House already voted to override the president's veto in the national defense bill. This is the first time Congress has ever voted to override a presidential veto. The Senate looks like it's going to do the same as of this taping. How did we get to this point, Jonathan?
What's interesting about this is that Bernie Sanders, the independent senator from Vermont who caucuses with the Democrats, is basically saying that unless Mitch McConnell agrees to have a standalone vote on the $2,000 checks to the Americans, Sanders is going to block any vote in the Senate to overturn the president's veto. So he's exercising his senatorial power to try to bring this $2,000 vote to the floor. McConnell has decided to create his own bill, which would include the $2,000 checks, but also two of the things that the president wants, which is some sort of law limiting the liability of making social media companies more responsible for the content on their sites, and also to look into election fraud. So he's proposing a commission to look into election fraud and some sort of action on social media companies.
As I said before, that there's very little chance that would pass the Democratic
exactly.
left.
That is
sort of dead on arrival. I want to continue to focus on the Senate for a minute because there's an important election happening right now in Georgia. Early voting has already begun. Two Senate seats are going to be decided. Tom, explain how important this election is, not only for who controls the Senate, but for what Joe Biden can do as president.
Bottom line at the moment is the Republicans hold a very narrow edge in the Senate. If the Democrats somehow win both these Senate seats in Georgia, the Senate will be 50-50, a tie. And under the rules of the Senate, a 50-50 tie means the vice president-elect, Senator Kamala Harris, will break a tie in favor of the Democrats. But it also means that the Democrats will take over control of the Senate. So it's critical for Republican interests that Republicans hang on to at least one of these seats. And so the bottom line is, there's a big difference between the Senate being controlled by Republicans, many of whom are not going to like many of what President-elect Biden's policies are, and the Senate being controlled by Democrats, even if it's evenly split 50-50. So the stakes are enormous, and the president, he is going down to campaign right before the election, but he seems somewhat ambivalent and indifferent. But the stakes of these two elections are critical for both the Democrats and the Republicans and for the new president.
The Republican candidates are very well aware that they do need President Trump's support. They both actually came out in support of the $2,000 check because they want to side with President Trump. They need the support from his base. Jonathan, it's a bit of a pickle, though, because President Trump, as Tom mentioned, he's going down to rally for these two senators. But President Trump has also been telling anyone who will listen that elections in this country are rigged. So he's both telling people down there to vote, but also in some ways that their vote won't count.
What I find really interesting here is the fact that something that you mentioned, Shana, and that is the support that the two Republican incumbent senators in Georgia have given to the $2,000 checks. This is my own view, but I would think that given the state of the country right now, the fact that the pandemic is out of control, that people are hurting economically, the economy is in bad shape, there would be more than just the two senators from Georgia who would support the $2,000 check. I think that if this were put to a standalone vote, there would be enough Republicans to vote for the $2,000 checks that the measure would pass in the Senate. And it's only the Republican leadership, the one of McConnell and those who have suddenly discovered fiscal responsibility after 4 years of ignoring it. They are the only ones who are standing against this, and I think that they would be defeated.
I'm sure if McConnell was on this conversation, on this call, he would push back and say he's always been fiscally responsible, so we're going to have to go with that. I want to take a break here, and when we come back, we're going to talk about President-elect Biden's transition, complaints that the outgoing administration, the Trump administration, is not cooperating with them, and we'll also get the latest on the distribution of vaccines here in the U.S. We'll be right back.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also, visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal. Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly, and our moderator, Shana Estulin, political and foreign affairs correspondent.
Welcome back to the show. Let's go to this topic. This coming Wednesday, it's an important date. It's the day Congress is set to certify the election results. By all appearances, they're going to declare that Joe Biden is the winner of the presidential election. We still don't know if and when President Trump will concede. He certainly hasn't conceded yet. He still insists that he won the election without any evidence. That refusal to concede seems to be bleeding into the transition and what information Joe Biden, the president-elect, is or isn't getting. At least that's what the Biden team has been alleging, that the Trump administration is not cooperating with them. What specifically are they upset about, Tom?
Well, they're specifically upset about what they allege is a lack of cooperation at the Pentagon and the Office of Management and Budget. And in the last few days, the president-elect himself has gone public saying this cooperation has not been forthcoming, and it smacks of irresponsibility. Whatever else it is or isn't, and of course the Republicans who control OMB, the Budget Office, and the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, say this is not true, but they don't do a very good job of convincing people by saying, well, we've had 400 meetings and we've given them 5,000 pages of this or that. There's apparently some classified information that the incoming Biden team feels they really need to know about. On the budget side, they feel like there's quite a bit of information about the distribution of the vaccine that they have not gotten very good information on.
Jonathan, is that something, I want you to jump in here, because is that something unusual? Isn't there generally tension between incoming and outgoing administrations, or are you seeing something different this time around?
This is unprecedented. It's not only different, it's unprecedented. A lot of people have used the analogy that the handoff during the transition from one administration to the other is very much like a relay race. And if you know anything about relay races, as one runner passes a baton to his relay partner, that relay partner is running at full speed so that when his teammate hands off the baton to him or her, that person can grab the baton and is already running at full speed. So there's no loss of time in the handoff. And what the Biden administration says they are finding is that as they are getting prepared to take possession of the baton, in other words, the U.S. government, the Trump people are not even running at all. It's not as if they're trotting or walking slow. They're not there. So the handoff is basically happening very, very, very slowly. And as Tom mentioned, and as you've mentioned, in certain departments, there is obstruction. They're not cooperating at all. There's one other fact that is very important to note, and that is that what Biden said when he criticized the Trump administration for not being cooperative on the handoff is that certain parts of the Pentagon have been totally hollowed out. So there really isn't any baton to hand off. Certain departments are just empty. Their people have left. They haven't had any record of what they've been doing. So there's really nothing to hand off there. That's very, very disturbing.
We heard a lot of criticism coming from Biden and his team, including his incoming National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, about this. As Tom pointed out, officials from the Pentagon and the OMB are pushing back. They say they are cooperating. Certainly, there are a lot of challenges ahead on this issue. I want to talk about another big challenge in the U.S., and that is the distribution of vaccines. We're now about 9-10 months into this pandemic. The numbers keep rising. At this point, according to data collected by the New York Times, at least 1 in 17 people have contracted the virus in this country. Over 335,000 people have died. An incoming member of Congress died from COVID. His name is Luke Letlow. He's from Louisiana. He was 41 years old. He's the first U.S. Congress member to die from the virus, although, as we know, dozens of others have been infected. The numbers are surging, especially as we're in this holiday season where people are traveling. We do have another vaccine that's getting into a late stage of the clinical trial, so more vaccines on the horizon, which is good. But Tom, how is the vaccine rollout going here in the U.S. from what you're seeing?
They call it Operation Warp Speed. There's no warp about this. As recently as a month ago, senior members of the government, they all said, we are confident that there will be 20 million doses of this vaccine administered into the arms of Americans by the end of the year. As of the moment, it's about 2.5 million doses have been administered, which is about a 90% shortfall.
Let's unpack this, Jonathan, with what Tom was saying. You've got this Operation Warp Speed. The Trump administration has gotten credit for this mission to work with private companies to fast-track vaccines. I mean, two vaccines were ready for the market within 9 months, which is remarkable. Even Joe Biden praised the administration on that. But there's a difference between getting vaccines to market and sending them out to states and getting those vaccines into people's arms. And that's what Tom was talking about, that the U.S. is at a very slow pace to actually giving people shots. Administration officials are defending their job. They're saying, look, we did a lot here. We sent out these vaccines. It's up to the states to figure out who gets it. Is it that simple that the federal government sends it out and then washes their hands and it's up to the states to figure out who gets the shot?
In short, no. The answer is no. The problem here is that just like the president did with testing and with the supply of personal protective equipment, what they call PPE in short, the president and the administration has left everything up to the states. However, the administration has not provided any of the infrastructure or the money to help the states with its distribution. So, for example, the states have not been told how many doses of the vaccines they're going to get. They have not been told which vaccine they're going to get, which affects the storage of the vaccine. For example, one vaccine, I think the Pfizer vaccine, requires extremely low temperature just to store it. The other vaccine does not require that. The administration has not provided the infrastructure that the states need in order to carry out what the administration says they ought to be doing. The president tweeted out that the system here is that we produce the vaccine, the federal government, and then we send it out to the states, and it's now up to the states to distribute this vaccine.
There does appear to be some money in this new relief package for states to help for distributing vaccines, but health experts are saying it's a little too late for that when states are struggling right now. Local health agencies have this massive task and not enough funding. Biden is promising to take a more aggressive approach. We'll see how they tackle this issue. This is going to be a big problem the next couple of months, especially as COVID numbers surge. I want to move to another topic. We have a couple minutes left. This was a big week for international news. The UK and the EU approved a post-Brexit deal between the two of them. It took 10 months to negotiate. It lays down the future relationship between the UK and the Europeans. From a U.S. perspective, Tom, this is good news for Biden because it means he comes into office and he doesn't have to play peacemaker between allies.
Exactly right. This is kind of like the development of a vaccine in terms of the timeline here. This Brexit deal between the United Kingdom and the European Union was put together in 9 months. That's remarkably swift, and it looks like a pretty respectable compromise. But
I'm sorry, did you just say the word swift when it comes to Brexit? It's not a word I usually hear when it comes to Brexit, for this deal.
Well, the trade agreement was negotiated in 9 months,
yes.
which is faster than the typical trade arrangement. And at least it's a compromise that seems to resolve certain of the more difficult issues, like whether you treat Ireland as a so-called hard border or other things. But the bottom line is, this is a problem that's been resolved at the moment, and that's not going to be at the top of the new president's list. He's going to have to broker a lot of things, but he's not going to have to worry about what's going to happen with the Brexit deal, because now there is one.
Right. That is true. Jonathan, I want to go to you for this last topic. We have a couple of minutes here. The suicide bombing Christmas Day in the U.S. city of Nashville. Law enforcement officials say a 63-year-old man, they've identified him as Anthony Warner, blew himself up with his motorhome in the city's downtown, damaging dozens of buildings, causing really just a ton of damage in the heart of the city. No one else was killed. We are learning now that a year ago, his girlfriend warned police that he was building explosives in his RV. What else do we know about this man, and do we yet know what his motive was?
We don't know a lot about this man. The FBI and other authorities are still looking into this. But the fact that he placed his RV in front of a AT&T building has led some authorities to speculate, and I emphasize the word speculate, that Mr. Warner may have been influenced by some conspiracy theories that say that the 5G networks, the new networks that telecommunications companies are using, somehow spreads COVID and other crazy ideas. So one of the theories is that he may have placed this car bomb or the truck bomb or RV bomb in front of AT&T to underscore embrace of this theory. But right now, it's not possible to know what the motive was.
Yeah, as you mentioned, the word is speculative. We still don't know what the motivation was.
Yeah.
Or what was behind this bomb that he detonated and killed himself. And thankfully, nobody else was killed in this explosion. Let's leave it here. That's all the time we have. Thanks to Tom DeFrank, contributing editor to the National Journal, and Jonathan Broder, contributing editor at Congressional Quarterly. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Shayna Stulen. Thanks for listening.